This episode of Revision Path is brought to you by Facebook Design. Diversity at Facebook is a big issue. So I asked John Lax how having a diverse workforce affects what Facebook creates.
We are designing for the world here, and the world is not comprised of one type of person. Diversity is essential for having us think about different voices, different opinions. Otherwise, we end up designing from one point of view, which is just not a way we're going to be able to connect the world. So diversity is hugely important to achieving our mission of connecting the world. We need as many different voices helping us build a product for all the different people in the world.
Learn more at facebook.com/design.
You're listening to the Revision Path Podcast, a weekly showcase of the world's Black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers. Through in-depth interviews, you'll learn about their work, their goals, and what inspires them as creative individuals. Here's your host, Maurice Cherry.
Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast. My name is Maurice Cherry, and before we get into this week's interview, let's talk about our sponsors, MailChimp and Hover. More than 12 million businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters. The holidays, of course, are in full swing, and no other email service provider is better when it comes to functionality as well as customer service. Sign up for a free account today at MailChimp.com. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a great domain name for it. That's where Hover comes in. Hover makes it easy for you to find that domain name that you're looking for and get it up and running with no hassle and no heavy-handed upselling. So go ahead and grab yourself a domain today and use our promo code REVISIONPATH and you'll save 10% off your purchase. Here's our Patreon fundraising campaign update. So we're still holding steady with 40 patrons for a total of $268 a month. Again, I want to thank all of you who have pledged your support and your appreciation for the show. If you enjoy what we're doing here at Revision Path, if you enjoy the guests that we have on the show, or if you've gotten any kind of value from listening, please do consider becoming a patron. Now more than ever, your patronage is super important, and you'll get some great perks like early access to future episodes. You'll get free Revision Path goodies based on the pledge level that you pledge at. Just go ahead and head over to patreon.com/revisionpath and make that happen. Pledge levels start at just $1 a month, and it's a great and affordable way to support the show on a regular basis. Now let's get on to this week's interview. So this is part two of our interview with product and systems designer Kai Jacobs. Let's start the show. So, how you feeling?
Wow, that's a complex question, right? For everybody right now. Well, I'm sure that everyone's probably dove deeply into what it feels like to be in the States right now, a Black person, a marginalized person, a thinking person, and dealing with the reality of our political and electoral system. But I'm one of those people outside of the U.S., and I have a feeling it's a slightly different experience.
What is it like now over there? I'm really curious, because I know that here in the United States, there's a lot of emotion going on. Clearly, Trump has been able to tap into a vein of rancor that has been building and bubbling and boiling in this nation for years, you know, mostly precipitated by President Obama's election and re-election. And has used that to propel him to victory. And because of that, now there's a lot of emotion. There's people are going through every single stage of the Kubler-Ross model of grief. Somewhere between bargaining and acceptance at this point. Yeah. What is it like over there? Because I don't know if a lot of people here realize just they don't realize the shockwaves that our presidential election has throughout the rest of the world.
Right, right. Not only the presidential election, but everyday American political and commercial maneuvering around the world has an impact on these countries that are very far, you know, geographically speaking, very distant from the U.S. So people are highly aware of the political situation in the States. They're highly aware of, well, that's about all they're highly aware of. Let's say they're highly aware, but they may not have a very detailed understanding of the nuance of the reality. Of course, American policy has so many effects on the environment that affects the globe, mm-hmm. on the global economy, setting political trends and other ways of impacting other countries around the world. So here I'm in the Netherlands, for example. I went to work on Wednesday morning, so that was exactly when all the results were kind of coming in, late Tuesday night in the States. And people were looking at me kind of like, I don't know, man. They were on pins and needles. They were afraid in a way to ask me how I was doing, because they have a sense of the ridiculous nature of what happened. They don't have a sense of what it means as a Black American. There's no way they can have a sense of the kind of threat that it posed to the safety of our bodies. They probably don't have an intricate and detailed sense of how the threats to American women's bodies has become much more real, mm-hmm. and much more threatening than before. They have a sense of the ridiculous. They understand the ridiculousness. And it's really deep, because if you look around, especially in Central Europe, there are countries who also have this kind of Trump type of this, let's say, far right wing, excessive, violent, and dangerous political ideology up in their mix. Mm-hmm. Germany, France, the Netherlands itself. There are right wing factions all over the industrialized and westernized world that are gaining power right now on a political level, because they're tapping in to a group of people that's very real.
How are you feeling specifically? I mean, I know you kind of talked about the general feeling. How is it affecting you and your family?
Yeah, it's been difficult. I mean, you know, it's already challenging for us. If you remove this question of politics, it's already difficult to be far away from people that you love and want to support and want to participate in their daily growth and their daily life. You want to be close to that because it feels good. That's humanity. That's family. Yeah. That's community. So we were already sort of like, okay, you know, missing that aspect and feeling removed and isolated because of that reality. And then you add this to the mix. So, you know, a colleague of mine said to me, don't worry, you know, you're safe here. Things can't happen to you. But the fact is that who I am is an extension of all those people that were responsible for raising me and who have impacted me and contributed to my personality, even my design vision. Like, as a designer, who I am is based on the people that I've been exposed to that raised me. So I can't be over here far from Trump or far from this white supremacist movement and feel like everything's okay, you know? Yeah, I'm sort of physically safe at the moment, but that doesn't matter. What about my nephew? What about mm-hmm. my cousins? What about, you know, my aunts and my uncles and my homies from around the way? It's like, there's very little that I can do to support everyone in this moment. And I am also traumatized. I'm also scared in my physical body. And it's been a challenge to be distant and to watch, and to only be able to watch at this moment, knowing that what I really want to do is participate in some sort of action, not necessarily saying, oh, let's reform this political system, but I do want to be on the street. If I see someone being harassed, I want to be in the street to assist them in whatever way makes sense in that moment. But that's something I can't do from all the way over here.
Do you think that it's happening even in a small way over there? Like, are people seeing, I don't know, I hate to even put it this way, are they seeing Trumpian actions happening over there?
I haven't picked up on any indications that there are new Trumpian activities. I like Trumpian. I like that a lot. I haven't seen any indications of new ones, but check it. Trumpian activities have been happening over here for a minute now.
Yeah.
A minute now. And, you know, even in the Netherlands, let's keep it real, like hyper local for me. If I look back to this past summer when the quote-unquote refugee crisis was happening, so we're talking about hundreds of thousands of Syrians, North and East Africans crossing the Mediterranean to come into these Central European countries, the reaction that the governments had on very high levels were very Trumpian, very Trumpian. There, I believe it was Hungary, even the leader of the nation of Hungary, when commenting on the prospect of people illegally crossing his border to try and obtain citizenship there, or not even citizenship, but to try and obtain like protection as a refugee, asylum, that's the word I'm thinking of. So the leader of Hungary was like, oh, people want to come here from Syria, for example, for asylum. Well, I would like them to know that I will shoot them, that you will be hunted down, that you will not be able to survive in this country. Like literally leaders of nations on that level. And this is very Trumpian, isn't it?
It very well could be. I mean, honestly, we'll have to see. I know that one of the things that's happening over here, which feels, I don't even know the best way to put it. It just feels slimy, is the fact that the media is already trying to mollify the anger and the emotion that people are feeling by like saying, oh, everything's going to be all right. Oh, we'll get through this.
Right.
Even though in large part they've been very complicit in the misinformation that has contributed to this rise in power.
Absolutely. And you know what? Design has a role in that. Let's bring it to where we at.
Okay.
Design has a role in that. The things and okay, design and technology, because now more than ever, what we are able to understand about psychology is a result of collecting data and having machines that can process information and make conclusions easier for us to achieve, to attain. And we use the understanding of human psychology and the functionality of human biology. We use that information to tap into people's cognition, don't we? Mm-hmm. The way we produce visual artifacts, the way we have elements move across the screen are increasingly more and more involving the understanding of human biology. So, and also cognition. Design is largely being infused with conclusions and strategy based on data and technology and our understanding of humans based on advances in those regions. Media machines, like media companies, their only layer of interaction with other people is what is consumed visually. This is design. Even if we're talking text, okay, I don't have to explain that to you or anyone listening to this show, that text alone, you know, if we're talking about people reading information that is influencing them, that information is received through a channel of design, and it is opinionated, and it is it features techniques that people decide to use. So yeah, I agree with you. The effort of the media now to try and change the psychology, to change the way people are thinking about this event, it seems slimy and evil. It also seems hereditary. Like that's what media has always done. And I just want to always be asking myself what my role is in that as a media creator, as a designer.
Right. I mean, in UI, they would call these dark patterns.
Exactly.
You know, this use of interface to trick people. And, you know, even here in the States, and I can't presume to know that it's like this in other countries, but when we look at something even just as simple as the ballot, and how it's designed and how things are worded to to possibly, you know, confuse people when they get to the ballot. They might not know exactly what to select. I even know, you know, here, one thing that I see a lot happening is people, like for the presidential election, for example, people know they're going to go and vote for the president. They don't know what else is on the ballot. They don't know about the down ticket races. They don't know about the amendments or the referendums, and they're worded, at least the amendments and referendums are worded in such a way where they're asking you six questions in a paragraph, and you've either got to say yes to all of them or no to all of them.
You're basically relying on alignment
Yeah, exactly.
Positional alignment. When I see posters or any kind of materials that are exploring civic issues, whether they're promoting an event or, yeah, it's maybe a flyer about an organization, so a bit of biographical information. When I see those pieces, they all, they typically seem well-designed, you know. It seems like people sat down and thought about, okay, how can we communicate a message? How can we make it feel contemporary and relevant to the context it'll be used in or the context it will be consumed in? I can see that in most design here in general. So that also extends to civic works or things mm-hmm. representing civic work. But there's a completely different social and economic dynamic here because of the very comprehensive and very supportive socialism. In other words, there is the line under which people can fall. No, that's not the best way to say it. A person who has lost access to resources, a person who is unlucky, a person who becomes ill. In the States, you can be very worried for this person because they can fall very far down. How many stories have we heard of people who had some sort of catastrophic medical emergency, and because of the cost of it, the rest of their life got ruined? Like, they had, in order to heal, they had to sacrifice their life. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And that's not a practice you'll find here because healthcare is so comprehensive and affordable. It's not something you don't see people so quick to become violent or even scared on a daily basis because people don't own weapons to the same degree. That's not a social aspect of this country. If you do find yourself without money, without a job, if you do find yourself as an asylum seeker here, fleeing from the horrors of another country, you may arrive here without any way to make money or any connections or any understanding of the language. But there's a social system here that says, okay, we're not going to let you fall to the ground. We're not going to let you become homeless on the streets. That's not the bottom. The bottom here is much more hospitable. So it's a different, there's a different sense of urgency around civic issues, to be honest. There's no industry around nonprofit organizations that need to support the people without voices. I mean, of course, there are people without voices, but okay, so they're living in social housing instead of, you know, following a path of, I don't know, economic independence. Okay, I don't know. It's just such a completely different paradigm out here, and it really makes what's happening in the States and other countries as well, it makes it look that much more ridiculous.
How does this make you feel about coming back?
It was a real question in my head before. The kind of question that is actually no, but you leave it open. Like, okay, if I had to choose now, I would say no. But I'm not beyond being convinced. That was my feeling on it before. In other mm-hmm. words, yeah, we could go back at some point. But not right now. There's no need to go right now. And today, well, you might imagine that the needle is no closer to wanting to go back. Or seeing right. that it even makes sense, you know. And I have a little bit of a radical take on it, I think, based on the way people react to something I'm about to say. Okay. But and I want to connect it to design again. Actually, I think we would agree that many successful designs are the result of people questioning what they feel is good design. Like, you sit down. You work on something for hours, you toil over it, at some point it feels good, and you show it to people. And even you might be the most humble and open-minded designer, but there's some part of you that really wants people to say, yes, I like that, that's good, don't change a thing. That's the reality of a creative. But the harder reality of a creative is that often the best designs that you can be responsible for are the result of you trying something, having it fail, and then people telling you that's failed, think of it another way. Try to take another angle at it. And that's mm-hmm. what I'm doing, not only with my design, but with this question of America. Let me think about this from another angle. I have family that's been in America since the 1700s. We, as a family, we are invested in that country. But why? Why are we invested in that country? Is it only because there's just, you know, we have loved ones there and we're spread all around, so that's just kind of where we are? Is that the only reason? Well, that's like saying a design, that's like saying all, you know, headers in web apps should use hamburger menu navigation because, well, it's out there. People are using it. You have to question that kind of rationale in design, and also I think in life and in politics and in these really big and hard questions. My wife and I decided to leave New York 3 years ago because we were leaving the house every day feeling legitimately concerned for the safety of our bodies. My wife, as a woman in the streets, all the harassment. As a black person in the streets, the threat from the police and institutional violence. This is a real concern for us. It was 3 years ago, and it's got to be a real concern for people today, you know, 10x. So the question we asked ourselves then, and it's a question I ask myself now when I think about the U.S., is why are we as a people so invested in holding on to that place? Why? Okay, I understand family. I understand, oh, this is my home. This is what I've known. But we're humans. We're adaptable. We need to be asking ourselves hard questions right now.
Well, I know that certainly. I was just thinking right after the election results really started to come out how the Canadian immigration website crashed. And there are actually several people I know that are actively, like seriously actively considering where else in the country can I move. And it's made me think about it in a way also because I have the wherewithal to go to another country if I wanted to? I mean, I've got a passport. Mm-hmm. I have marketable skills. Mm-hmm. I could make that happen. Yeah. Or, like you said, you have to ask the tough question. Like, yeah, could I just decide to say, you know what, y'all got it, I'm out? Mm-hmm. Or what can I do here to improve the condition mm-hmm. that clearly is going to get worse mm-hmm. just based on the rhetoric that this person has spouted for the past 18 months?
Yeah, but
it's the level of investment, like yeah. you said. You have to ask yourself, how invested are you?
Yeah. Well, also, I have to ask, can we draw any conclusions yet from 400 years of history in the U.S. Actually, let's take it even farther back. Look at the North Dakota pipeline access situation, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, so you can't see me, but I'm shaking my head hard over here because I'm thinking about my Native brothers and sisters. I'm thinking about the First Nations people, a powerful people, a connected people historically, people who were in the Americas first. They had the pole position. They had the advantage of being there first. And let's zoom ahead let's take it thousands of years into the future, which brings us to today. What is the condition of First Nations people right now? What's the condition of those powerful, connected, deep humans right now in North America? Their condition is deplorable. It is depressing. They've been destroyed as a people. So what I'm asking is, can we look at the history of America and draw a conclusion that sounds something like, maybe it's not worth fighting for this space? Maybe the idea that we should fight a power is, yes, it connects to a sense of pride and this idea of us always being able to be resilient and powerful. We are that. That's in our DNA. That's Africanness. We're always going to have that. But is that all that we ever have? Because if I look at the history of black people and Africans in America, that's all we've ever been allowed to have, is the need to resist, to fight, and to be resilient after getting taken down again and again and again.
Yeah.
Man.
No, that is definitely something to think about. I mean, I'm even just thinking of, I think I saw someone mention this on Twitter when they were talking about how God, I'm trying to remember what the exact thing was. I'm actually going to pull it up so I don't get it wrong. Someone was saying, I'm going to make sure that I find this right one. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to find it because I'm scrolling through here. But it was something along the lines of, you know, y'all keep, you know, people keep saying that, oh, well, black people have survived worse.
Right.
In terms of you know, what's going on in this country. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how much, I'm, you know, maybe as a black person, I'm not trying to see what my upper threshold of pain
is. Right.
Maybe what I've been through enough in this black body, in this life, on this earth. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't be trying to press my luck with that.
Indeed.
I wouldn't say press my luck. I don't want to say it that way. But I you know, how much do you really want to know how much you can take?
Right. And why is that a measure of the value of us as a people? Right? I mean, I get it in the context of a group of people surviving something so horrific as the transatlantic slave phenomenon. The diaspora. Mm-hmm. I get it, like, wow, if you look at us, damn, we are some survivors. Of course we are. But we're so many other things too. And 2016, for me, 2016 has been that year that shows me in so many different ways about the multidimensionality of black people. And it feels like for so many years we've been denied the ability and the strength and the opportunity to represent that aspect of black humanity. So now I'm being asked to forget all that, actually, and just go back to that old one, that one that feels like it's from the 1600s, where you the only way you can see tomorrow is if you sustain the pain of a whip on your back. It's like, mm-hmm. What happened to our most multidimensionality, actually?
Yeah, that's, and I mean, I'm, it's certainly something that I am thinking about because, again, like you say, I'm in a position where if I wanted to make that happen, I probably could. I mean, it wouldn't be something I could instantly just pick up and make happen, but in the next year, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. like if I see what's this first year going to look like, because I know that, you know, President-elect Trump has already put out his 100 days of what he wants to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And it's like the Red Wedding from Game of Thrones. Yo, like
it really is. And his cabinet suggestions or like his plan, the people he's planning to try and vet, like, whoa.
Yeah. Like it's, but yeah, like you said, do you want to stick around for the purge? Yeah. I don't know.
And look, this isn't, there's even a very, very significant historical precedent amongst black folks of us getting up and getting out of there when things got crazy. I'm specifically referring to the Great Migration. It started in 1910, around there, about 6 million black folks moving from the south of the U.S. to Chicago, New York, L.A., mostly, right?
Okay.
The Great Migration. It lasted until, I don't know, maybe like 1960, something like 1950. So a number of years where black people, and I'm talking about 6 million of us, moved. We got out of there because mm-hmm. we were suddenly able to. The only thing that had stopped us before was physical chains and the threat of violence. And at a certain point, the political climate changed. Historical factors allowed us to start to move, and we moved. Black folks got out of there. So I don't even, you know, if black folks start to move again right now as a result of this political climate, I don't think it's unprecedented. It's just that, just like everything, if you compare today's version of the thing versus the early part of the last century's version of the thing, let's take communication, for example. People still talk to each other, just like they did in 1910, but now we do it in vastly different ways. People still find their freedom like they did in 1910 in the Great Migration, but we can do it now in different ways. So we need to ask those hard questions. Like, why am I doing this right now? What is available to me? But you mentioned something that made me think about privilege. Like, what I heard you saying was that you have the ability which we recognize that not everyone has. Not everyone has the financial financial resources. Not everyone has the social arrangement. Like, some people are imprisoned. What are we going to do with all the folks in prison? So you're right. There's also that aspect. Like, we have, some of us, only some of us, have the kind of privilege that can allow us to casually say, all right, I'm moving to Canada. By the way, did you see Erica Joy's piece on Medium about moving to Canada or thinking about Canada?
No, I did not see that. What was that
okay,
about?
Okay, well, I mean, she definitely had a political leaning. You know, it was like a bit of a political piece about her understanding of Hillary Clinton's campaign. And in the context of that, she was sort of imagining what it would be like to make the decision to move to Canada, also exploring some of the challenges of wanting to move to Canada to solve this kind of a problem. I enjoyed the read, like I do all of her pieces. The thing about this one, though, that caught me was all of the responses to her piece. Now, Medium, I always considered to be pretty, like the commenting there, I never really had problems with it. I could read divergent opinion, and I didn't feel like people were trying to attack each other. It seemed pretty civil. Civil, I guess, is a good word. But I looked at the comments to Erica Joy, this black woman, an engineering director, I think she is, this black professional woman voicing her political ideas and opinions and thinking about leaving the country to preserve her safety and her sanity. And the comments to her thoughts were pure vitriol from people on Medium who were, you know, clearly identifiable. People saying things like, I'm paraphrasing, but things like, good, get out of here. Okay. People saying things like, I hope Donald Trump comes to your house and drags you into Canada and leaves your ass there. These kinds of comments on Medium, I've never seen that kind of commenting on Medium. And I think it was really indicative. It was really indicative of the shift.
Wow. I mean, she works for Slack. Mm-hmm. Slack does have a Vancouver office. She goes to Canada. Right. And it's close enough to the States where, you know, she could pop back in and out. It's not that far from Seattle. Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah. Really, really deep right now. You know, it made me think of a few other events, obviously 9/11, but I also thought about Challenger, the Challenger shuttle exploding with the teacher on board.
Yeah.
I thought about the tsunamis, and like the Indian Ocean tsunami, the Japanese tsunami, and I thought about the Haitian earthquake. Because for me, in my lifetime, these were moments where something outside of my little bubble, something in the world happened on such a scale. And it was so visceral and real and a turning point in my personal history these are things I'll never forget. And, you know, the election of this guy and the change in the House and the change in the Congress, the shifting of people, of the way people express themselves towards others. This is very visceral to me, and I think is an opportunity for us, to be honest. I think it's an opportunity for us to engage with the moment we're in. Because I think largely we're being overwhelmed by the media we're creating and consuming. I mean, that's not a rare perspective. But what it means, for example, is like in this moment, we are so surprised that we're knocked off of our feet. We're traumatized because of the bubble we put ourselves in. And maybe this is an opportunity to either embrace the sort of the clarity of vision we now have, or it's an opportunity to harness the emotional and intellectual and I'll even take it to the metaphysical level, like the things that we're all experiencing right now inside of us. Harness those things. Like, don't try to suppress it. Like, we started the conversation talking about how media is trying to spin this to get people to be calm and to be placated and relaxed. You know, let's get back to, you know, normal, right? Let's back to the status quo.
Right.
Let's not forget. Let's not let go of this very strong and visceral reaction we're having. Let's make use of it. Let's direct it towards something. Maybe it's you trying to change some aspect of the electoral college system, because I hope everyone sees now what a farce that is. But maybe it's also us directing this energy towards the media we're creating. You're doing that with this conversation on your podcast. I mean, you've been doing that for years. But for me, it's made me think about what I can do. And amongst the different creative things that I do, the creative activities that I engage with on a daily basis, how can I channel what I'm feeling right now into that work and into those things? Because this is a significant moment, and I don't want us to lose it in the noise of the pundits and the fear, because the fear makes us want to go back to that normal that we knew, even if it was still dangerous. It was just masked and described and designed in a different way.
Well, and it also makes me think about, you know, the fact that, you know, we do have to speak up. We have to say something, do something, because I think, how can I put this? We certainly don't want to be silent, because, of course, you know, you always keep hearing about how silence equals, you know, consent with what's going on with a particular issue or things like that. And I know from the design community that tends to be the default response when it comes to issues that have to deal with social justice is silent. Well, let me take that back. The default response seems to be silence about issues of social justice if they happen here.
Okay.
If they happen in Turkey or Egypt or, you know, another country overseas.
A safe distance away.
A safe distance away. Designers will hop to it and start creating things. But, you know, police brutality here.
Yeah.
Voter disenfranchisement here.
Right.
You know, whatever is going to happen when Trump gets into office and starts wielding power. Yeah. You know, it makes me think about what designers can do to step up and say something, because I don't want us to be silent. It got me actually thinking about this conversation I had with, and I keep referencing this conversation with her because it was so good. Cella Lewis, who was on the show recently.
I listened to that episode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we kind of had this conversation about how even during the civil rights movement, where there was clearly, you know, a huge divide between white America and everyone else, particularly Black Americans, and how a lot of the designers of the time, a lot of the big name designers, were just kind of business as usual.
Right.
And weren't necessarily talking about or designing things towards the movement. And so, right. I mean, you have someone like Emery Douglas, who clearly is born of the movement, and his work clearly is intrinsically linked to that time. But you, I mean, I don't know if there's like a Milton Glaser piece or a Massimo Vignelli piece, you know. And even now, when we look at our big designers, we look at our you know, Jessica Hishes and Eddie Opara and Paula Scherer or whatever. I mean, are they, why, you know, are the big names of the design community going to say something? Do they feel like they can say something, that they should say something? Because to not say anything means that you think that this is fine.
Right. You think it's fine, or you are...
You don't think it affects you.
Yeah. Right. The election, to me, seems like people voted, particularly white American or white women, they voted as a bloc, saying that Donald Trump was no worse for them than Hillary. And now, considering that Donald Trump is apparently a rapist and gropes women and is committed sexual assault and revels in it, considering that, white women felt like that didn't trump or that didn't outweigh the other advantages that they will get with a person like Trump and his regime in office. So a lot of the design community is actually women and actually white women. A lot of the design community are white women. Mm-hmm. Of course, white men as well. So these people actually have an interest that can be served by someone like Trump and the shift in the political ideology and government. So do they even have an interest beyond what may seem like them wanting to appear, you know, humanitarian and liberal you know, likable by all, they might not have a legitimate interest in speaking up and protecting those who are now under threat.
I mean, that's...
I hope it's not.
God, that's sad. If that is the case, I hope it's not either, but that's really sad if that is the case.
I hope it's not. I mean, like you said, we've seen more silence than sort of non-activism, because yeah, indeed, we see people express solidarity. We see people express solidarity with others around the world when situations are bad, whether that's a political badness or an environmental badness. So we know that the design community has a voice. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it will manifest. But maybe it's more like, okay, how are we gonna manifest the design community's voice based on our own voices?
I was gonna say that's even interesting to think of when you look at design media and whose voices are the ones that are always being put in the forefront. It's not from people of color.
Yeah.
It's mainly from white men.
But you know what? There's a big part of me that really, I want to try to start ignoring that question, although it's really big inside of me as well. I want to try to ask myself the hard questions without considering something like the white gaze or the gaze of others outside of our community. I want to try... Even in terms of my design, you know, when I sit down to start a design project, I always start with inspiration. I always look at what other people whose work I respect, what they're doing in that design context. And it works for me. That's a good process. But it's also me starting my creative process outside of myself. It's often efficient. It often makes sense. And I often get good ideas and good results from that process. But now that I'm thinking about how we do a creative process, how we design something that speaks to our needs, maybe we really have to start, you know, without considering what's happening outside of us. We have to start inside of us, inside of our community, and just assume that we don't have the support, we don't have the allies from other communities. I mean, I think we will from other brown skin folks, because we're all in the same boat a bit more now, or at least it's clear to more people that we're in the same boat. But my overall point is that I think we have what we need without having to be concerned or even to wait up or to hold up and allow others to catch up to us who are not inside of our community. I think we have what we need. 2016 has shown me that already.
I think that's a good place to end it. Thank you for sharing your... No, I don't really have... I have anywhere to go from there, but thank you for sharing too.
I mean,
for sharing.
You
know,
when you reached out to me, I was like, yeah, let's talk. Anyone I can get a chance to talk to about this, it helps me. It's kind of like teaching. Like you hear teachers say when they get to talk about their ideas, when they have to present their ideas in a way that's clear enough for others to understand, they also work through those ideas and have a better understanding and a more nuanced and sophisticated understanding of those ideas simply by having to organize their thoughts about them. And that's also why I look forward to talking with you. It gives me a chance to actually talk these ideas out loud, organize them inside my head, and make sure that they actually resonate with me and that they're not someone else's ideas, or that that I'm not just sort of being led or influenced by something outside of me. So it's been an important and healing conversation for me, to be honest. Thoughts of love are in
your mind. And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Kaid Jacobs, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about Kaid and his work through the links in the show notes at revisionpath.com. Thanks as always to our sponsors, Facebook Design, MailChimp, and Hover. Facebook invests in design. They care deeply about how their design team might do their best work, and that manifests itself in a number of different ways, such as building tools like Origami, sharing what they've learned on Medium, and by giving back to the design community. Learn more about Facebook Design at facebook.com/design. More than 12 million businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters. Their attitude may be playful, but their business is serious. Sign up for a free account today. MailChimp. Send better email. Hover takes all the hassle and confusion out of buying and managing your domains. Just search for a few keywords and Hover will show you the best available options across all the 400 plus domain extensions out there. Ready to get started? Save 10% off your first purchase by using the promo code RevisionPath at checkout. This episode was edited by RJ Basilio and produced by me, Maurice Cherry. Our intro voiceover is by Music Man Dre, with intro and outro music by Yellow Speaker. If you liked this episode, please do me a huge favor. Leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. It only takes a minute or two. It really bumps the show up in those iTunes rankings for design podcasts so more people can find out about us. And I'll even read your review right here on the show. Revision Path is brought to you by Lunch, a multidisciplinary creative studio in Atlanta, Georgia. If you like the work that we're doing with the podcast and with the website, then visit us over at Patreon and become a patron. Just go to patreon.com/revisionpath and pledge your support. Pledge levels start at just $1 per month, and you'll get access to behind-the-scenes information about the show, upcoming interviews, and so much more. And just before we go, I want to wish all of you out there happy holidays, Merry Christmas, joyous Kwanzaa, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year, all of that. We're going to be taking next week off, so there won't be a new episode next week. It'll be a great chance to kind of catch up on any past episodes in case you've missed anything. And we will be back here on January the 2nd with a new episode. So again, I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you all for really making this such an amazing year for me, both personally and professionally with Revision Path. And we'll see you next time.